toasts, and cake cutting were done. But really, in a perfect wedding, or world, you wanted the best possible beginning. Start on a high note, and no matter what song follows, chances are just better that it will be music to your ears. At 9:47, despite the strict 10 p.m. sharp ending on the schedule, the dance floor remained crowded. Still, I took no comfort in the fact I'd been right talking to Jilly earlier. The day had been unexpectedly hot for the end of April, and the combination of stress, sunshine, and multiple hours on my feet had taken a toll. I didn't want to go to Bendo, much less make the effort required to be out there with two boys I didn't even know. And I definitely didn't want to dance. Which was why, when Ambrose Little emerged from the back of a rather sloppy-looking electric slide line, spotted me, and beckoned, I only shook my head. This was a no-brainer, but not because of anything to do with him. The golden rule of working a Natalie Barrett wedding: remember your place. It wasn't unusual for clients, over the course of many months of planning, to develop a certain dependency on us. Huge life events that were fraught with emotion often led to displaced feelings. However, nobody wants to look at their pictures later and see their wedding planner acting like a guest. My mom always reminded extra employees we took on from time to time for bigger events, if we don't stay out of frame, we haven't done our job right. So I wasn't surprised to be asked to dance. It happened, especially at open bar events. I was, however, not expecting him to respond to my no by shaking his own head, then walking right over and sticking his hand out to take mine.
"Dancing is healing," he said, opening his palm wide to me as the music faded out and another song began. "Let's heal."
"No, thank you," I said. He wiggled his fingers wildly, as if imitating a sea anemone might suddenly sway my opinion. "Thanks, but no," I told him, switching up my three allowed words in this situation. "Ambrose!" A girl in a short pink dress, her now bare feet crisscrossed with the evidence of previously worn sandals, hollered from the floor. "Get over here! We need you for the conga line!"
"Hear that?" he said to me. "Conga! You gotta get in on this."
When again I shook my head, he sighed loudly, then bent over with his hands on his knees, as if my response was now so tragic it had knocked the wind out of him. After a second, he lifted his head, then one hand, busting out the sea anemone move again.
"Conga.
Healing. Let's go." "No, thanks," I told him. People were starting to form the line now, stumbling as they grabbed onto each other, laughing and flushed. If there was a benchmark of the beginning of the end of a reception, this was it. Ambrose looked over, grinned, then turned back to me.
"Don't worry," he said. "I don't have to squeeze tight."
"You won't have to squeeze at all," I said, "because the answer is still no."
"Aren't you supposed to be working this event?"
"I am."
"So you should dance, then."
"That's not how it works."
"Why?"
The last thing I felt like doing was getting into the parameters of my job with a clumsy, wavering conga line approaching. "I'm not a guest. I'm an employee. We don't dance. We work." He considered this briefly.
"Okay, then I'm asking you to be my date. You're off duty."
"That's not how it works either," I told him.
"Man, you are tough."
He shook his head, that curl I couldn't seem to not focus on bobbing. The conga line was now winding around a nearby chair, a red-faced man with a cigar clamped in his mouth leading it.
"So what you're saying is that you are never going to dance with me right now, no matter how I plead or beg you, even if conga is involved."
"Correct," I said.
"Really?" He made a face. Shoot, I hate not having what I want. This was such a weird thing for him to say. Arrogant, honest, that I found myself, for the first time, without a set response at hand. But as the conga line came up behind him, the girl in pink letting out a whoop as she reached for his belt buckle, I almost wished for a final beat to address this thought. One I still had myself, more often than I could admit. I hate not having what I want. Don't we all, I said quietly, as the line blurred past me, weaving through the tables. And just like that, I reached the point where the whole thing was too much color and life and laughter, and all I could do was turn and walk away. Chapter 3. Ethan asked me to dance at a wedding, too, and I said no, the first time. But that was later in the story, this one I'd once told others so eagerly, and now could only repeat to myself in my own head. You'd think in retrospect time would become linear, as if distance from events forced them to take their proper places. But something like this, I'd learned, was more fluid, as if the story was always being retold in progress, whether you could bear to listen or not. I was doing it again, jumping around. But it was so hard to start at the beginning when you knew how it would end. It all happened at the Margie Love wedding the previous summer. My mother did not like doing out-of-town weddings and rarely took them on, maintaining that she was only as good as her vendors, which were all local. Margie Love's grandpa, however, was dear friends with William's mother, as the original benefactor of the business, Miss May, as she was known, had a certain clout even my mother couldn't deny. Aged 80 and in assisted living, she rarely asked for favors, but when she did, the answer was always yes. So that August, after 10 months of long-distance planning with Margie, in D.C., and her mother, in California, we packed up for a weekend in the beach town of Colby, where they'd vacationed as a family every summer of Margie's life. The venue was only about 3 hours from our house door to door, and actually not a bleak, unpopulated place where weddings had never happened before. Not that you could tell this by how stressed my mom was, or the amount of stuff she insisted we bring. 3 vans worth, one of us driving each, to ensure she'd have everything she required. My mom was wound pretty tight as a rule, at least when it came to work. But even I had rarely seen her so tense and snappy, which was why, when we finally pulled out caravan style from the front of the house, I was happy to have the ride all to myself with just the radio for company. Still, I missed Jilly, who had been planning to come along with me and hang out on the beach or in my room while I worked. This would have been a first for her. An entire weekend away from her family, and we'd both been looking forward to it. It wasn't easy for the bakers to do without her and juggle their 2 cheese therapy food trucks. They sold gourmet grilled cheese and the richest, creamiest tomato soup I'd ever tasted, which was why she usually ended up being the substitute hands-on parent to one or all of her siblings. This weekend, though, they'd promised her a pass in return for a busy summer of ferrying the twins and Crawford around, as well as changing endless diapers of Beans. 2 days earlier, however, Cheese Therapy had been one of only 20 trucks selected for a food truck rodeo at the state capitol, celebrating small local businesses. It was a big deal, and they needed all hands on deck, so our getaway was out. So Jilly would spend the weekend corralling her siblings and working the cheese therapy register while scoping out cute boys in a bigger city. Meanwhile, I'd go to Colby, where I'd spend Friday night assisting my mom and William with the rehearsal dinner, a clam bake on the beach with a tiki hut theme, and Saturday working the main event, formal, at a hotel overlooking the ocean, surf and turf stations to follow. If I'd actually been a guest, this probably would have sounded great. As it was, all I could think about was the combination of food and sand, never good in practice, and a very important wedding taking place in a venue I'd not yet seen. At home, we had extensive notes on every place we'd staged ceremonies, detailing pertinent issues like hard-to-find exits, squeaky floors, or rattling pews. Out of town, though, we were everywhere for the first time. At least it was a nice weekend, warm with sunny and clear skies forecast, and I would be at the beach. With this in mind, I'd splurged earlier in the week on a new black sundress and gold-accented sandals for the occasion. As we drove east, the subdivisions and interstates giving way to farmland and two-lane roads, I could feel the work-related kink in my neck slowly relaxing. I could only hope the drive was having the same effect on my mother in the van ahead of me. Once over the bridge to Colby, we turned onto the main road, which was bottlenecked with tourists. "Fresh shrimp," read one sign I studied as I crawled along, followed by, "Who needs traffic? Rent a bike from Abe's," with an arrow pointing to the nearby boardwalk. After what felt like an hour of exhaust, brake lights, and the occasional glimpse of ocean, blue and wide, we finally turned into the lot of a high-rise hotel called The Piers. The main building was so white in the bright sun that just looking at it made my head hurt. As I parked, pushing open the door, I could already hear my mother complaining. So much for a relaxing drive. "This sun," she said to William instead of hello, as he walked over. As usual, he was perfect and unruffled in his khakis, short-sleeved checked shirt, and very clean white Adidas sneakers. In contrast, my outfit, after 3 hours in the car, looked like I'd balled it up in my hand multiple times. There were a lot of things I envied about William, just about everything, actually, but top on the list was how he always looked serene and flawless, even under the most dire of circumstances. "Old New England suppression and denial," he called it, which made it sound less like something to covet. I still did, though. Now he just looked at my mom, reflected in his aviator sunglasses, flapping her arms around and trying to kick up a breeze as she continued. "At almost exactly this time tomorrow, we'll have a 16-member wedding party in full dress out in this. If everyone doesn't faint, it will be a miracle."
"You're forgetting the pergolas," he said mildly.
"We didn't insist on them, and the fluttering tulle, purely for the looks of it." "We'll need a lot more than fluttering tulle to deal with this," my mom grumbled, dabbing at her, not sweaty from my view, brow. "But that's tomorrow. Let's find the caterer and see how this dinner is shaping up. Luna, can you start the unloading? The ballroom door is supposed to be just over there behind the dumpsters and unlocked. They're expecting us." "Great," I thought, even as I nodded. They'd go into the AC to talk tiki torches while I schlepped boxes of centerpieces, my mother's preferred table linens, and glassware across a hot parking lot. I could still hear her complaining as they walked away. That night, the rehearsal went well, with only a few basic wrinkles. Meltdown from flower girl, bossy wedding planner wannabe, aunt of bride, impatient officiant. This last was a pet peeve of us all. Nobody liked a snappy minister. By the time Margie and her groom, Joseph, play-walked down the aisle together, with her carrying the bouquet of ribbons from her bridal shower, everyone was ready for a drink. As they adjourned to the beach, my mother had the caterers waiting with trays of champagne, the tiki torches lit and flaming around them. Let the party begin. "Well, that's done," she said to William, giving a cordial but not exactly warm nod to the bossy aunt as she passed us. Here's hoping the actual event goes so smoothly.
That was smooth?
He asked, his eyes following a bridesmaid in wobbly platform sandals who was trying to navigate the steps to the beach.
Just once I'd like to get an officiant who was happy to do their job.
Like you're always happy to do yours?
Exactly, William replied.
A pause. Then they both laughed as if this was hysterical. I rolled my eyes, turning back to the party as two of the groomsmen walked by us. One of them was about my age and built like a football player, with dark hair cut short and blue eyes. The kind of boy that you can easily picture as a little kid, that cute. As he passed by, he smiled at me, and I felt my face flush even as I tried to imitate my mother's efficient, businesslike nod in return. Once he went down the stairs to the beach, I realized William was watching me, amused, and felt embarrassed all over again. After the dinner, the guests moved the party to the hotel bar and, thankfully, out of our jurisdiction. I helped my mom, William, and the caterers break down the tables and chairs, then brought a purse, a phone, and a monogrammed flask to the hotel lost and found. Someday, I'd write an entire book about the things people left behind at weddings. I just had this feeling it all meant something. By 10:30, I was back in my room eating a pack of crackers from the vending machine and texting with Jilly, who was in a hotel room with Crawford watching a marathon of swamp fishing shows while the youngers, her term, all slept.
So bored, she reported.
If I see another catfish, I might scream. Tell me you are going to go out and do something epic tonight.
Of course I am, I wrote back.
Sure, I bet you are in bed already.
I balled up the cracker wrapper, threw it in the general direction of the nearby trash can, and missed.
I'll do epic tomorrow, promise. You better. If I can't, you have to.
I made a face. This was a familiar rant from Jilly, who had been long convinced that I squandered the relative freedom I enjoyed as an only child of a single, non-food truck-owning parent. In my shoes, she was fond of telling me, she'd be the kind of person who was always out doing stuff and making things happen. The specifics of what exactly these terms meant were never explained. As with any fantasy, vagueness was part of the appeal. Moreover, it wasn't just a waste of my life, but of hers as well, that I willingly spent time away at the beach, sitting in bed watching a news special about a murder mystery while covered in cracker crumbs. I wasn't Jilly, and never would be, but I would have given her some of my open hours if I could have. She definitely deserved them. The next morning, I went for an early run and jumped into the hotel pool before showering and meeting my mom and William for our scheduled 9 a.m. strategy breakfast. Over a table of pastries, coffee, and fruit, we synchronized schedules, divided up our to-do list for that morning, and went over the cheat sheets I'd printed out in the hotel business center. By 10:30, I was back in one of the vans navigating the streets of Colby in what was basically a glorified scavenger hunt. According to my bullet-pointed list, we needed a hardback, attractive, but not too embossed Bible. The family one had been forgotten back in California. 4 black bow ties and 2 rolls of pennies, preferably polished. These items could have been challenging to procure even back in Lakeview, which had several malls and a thriving retail district downtown. Colby, however, offered up much less in terms of options, which was why an hour later I'd only gotten the bow ties. Lily's Occasions, the only formal wear place, did not look kindly on renting out accessories last minute. I had to promise they'd be returned by noon sharp on Sunday, pay twice the normal price, and slip the owner $40 cash before she'd let me take them, and even then I could feel the stink eye on me all the way out to the parking lot.
So I was already visibly beaten down by the time I found a Bible at the local bookstore and basically pleaded with them for some rolls of pennies from their safe, which they gave me purely out of pity. "There you are," my mom said to me when I finally returned to the private dining area off the ballroom we were using as ground zero for our planning. All the flower arrangements were lined up on a nearby table, programs already folded and stacked beside them. "Did you get the pennies?" "I got some pennies," I said, pulling the rolls from my pocket and putting them next to where she was sitting at the head of a table, her folders organized in a clock-faced pattern around her. Each one held a task that needed to be completed before the ceremony began, and she'd move through them accordingly, checking each off as she went. But they aren't polished. That's not as important as getting them on the cards. Cards? Instead of answering, she reached for a yellow folder not in the clock face, pulling it toward her. Everything at Natalie Barrett weddings was color-coded, so I didn't even have to see the, neatly printed in Williams' writing, label on it to know it held last-minute items. She flipped it open, taking out a sheet of paper and handing it to me. Joseph's mom was named Penny. She died of cancer when he was 10. They've decided to honor her by handing out cards with her name, dates, and a bright, preferably shiny penny to each guest. "And this happened in the last 2 hours?" I asked, having no recollection of hearing anything like it during the previous months of planning. It was decided last night at the gathering after the dinner. This was such a dreaded practice, we actually had an acronym for it. A last-minute DAB, i.e., decided at bar. "Please tell me you are kidding." "I wish I was," she sighed, her face tired. "Now, I know you are going to hate me, but I need you to go back out and pick up the cards from the printer. They were a rush job and are already paid for and ready." "Seriously?" "I said you'd hate me," she replied, as if this actually made anything better. And plus, I couldn't hate her anyway. She'd never made a DAB. She was way too organized. "Just remember, next summer you'll be almost out of here to college. No more tasks like this. You can get a nice, normal job, like selling produce." This was what she'd started saying to me at times like this, as if a promise of weighing cucumbers in the future softened any current blow. It was also as close as she'd come to addressing me leaving for school, something so fraught with emotion she wasn't even able to joke about it. Yet. I said, "I know you're trying, but the idea of working at a farmer's market is hardly a comfort right now." "No?" She gave me a sympathetic look. "How about this? Get the cards, and I promise, barring any unforeseen disasters, you can knock off early tonight." "Define disasters. No. I refuse. It's like tempting fate." She shut the folder. "Just say yes to the offer, will you? A free night at the beach. You can study up on the produce business." "You're not funny," I grumbled. "Maybe not, but I am desperate." She took a quick, apologetic glance at the van keys, which I'd deposited next to the pennies. "In all seriousness, I wouldn't push on this, but the client gets what the client wants," I said, before she could complete yet another one of her mantras. I picked up the keys. "But I am not polishing pennies. I draw the line there." "That's fine. William will do it." "Wait, what?" William said, entering the room at precisely that moment. "What am I doing?" My mom pretended she didn't hear him. "Just think about weighing those cucumbers next summer," she called out as I started to the hallway. "So easy, so relaxing." I didn't reply, just waved a hand behind me as William said, confused, "Cucumbers?" At 6 p.m. sharp, Margie walked down the aisle on the arm of her father, looking gorgeous in her cap-sleeved gown with a bejeweled bodice and crying happy tears. We'd hit the jackpot on the weather. Warm, but not too hot. A good breeze, but not enough to send veils and dresses billowing up. The only wrinkle was a loud Coast Guard helicopter flying by low over the beach and drowning out the beginning of the vows. Even my mother couldn't control the military, although I would not have put it past her to try. After the ceremony, I sat in the BRR as the wedding party and then guests exited to the ballroom, where the bars were open and the DJ already playing beach music, the bride and groom's favorite. Once the chairs were empty, I helped some guys from the piers fold and stack them to clear space for what would later be the dance floor. Left behind were crumpled programs, a few stray tissues, and, to me, entirely too many of the penny cards William and I had hastily assembled in record time before the ceremony. Oh, well. Once the ceremony was complete, there was always an easing in my mother's tension. So I wasn't entirely surprised when she joined me during dinner as I stood guarding the display of M and J cupcakes on the cake table. While guests rarely messed with a wedding cake, something about cupcakes brought out serious grabby hands, and not just in children. Until the pictures were taken, though, they were off limits, which meant body blocking them while saying, "Not yet," in a cheerful yet firm voice to anyone who tried to approach. It was one of my least favorite jobs, and one William loved. But he was tied up taking over for a queasy bartender until backup arrived, so it fell to me. "Did you see how many people ditched those penny cards?" my mother said, her eyes moving over the crowd in front of us. "Talk about dishonoring the dead." "DABs are always a mistake," I told her, as a flower girl carrying a full plate of steak and pasta started for the cupcakes. When I stepped forward, she veered off, her dress hem dragging on the carpet behind her. "If any idea is good, we've already thought of it." She looked at me, smiling, proud. "Listen to you," spoken like a real wedding planner. "Or a future cucumber seller," I replied. "And I'm still knocking off early tonight. You promised." "I know, I know." She reached behind us, picking up a stray crumpled napkin and tucking it in her pocket. "I also know I've been lucky to have you working with us these last few years. Although it's not like I really gave you a choice." "I am getting another job once I start college," I told her. "God, I hope so." She shuddered theatrically. "I cannot be responsible for sucking someone else into a lifetime of this business. I already feel bad enough about William." I looked over at the bar across the room, where at that moment the man in question was chatting away while salting the rim of a margarita, two older women in jewel-toned dresses hanging on his every word. "I don't think he minds it so much." She smiled, seeing this too. "Oh, he does. He just can't do anything else, like me." This was big talk, and I was used to it. My mom and William always discussed the business as if it, too, was a bad relationship they couldn't wait to break off. And yet, they kept coming back, bickering over choices of clients and laughing at inside jokes I'd never understand. The longest, most successful relationship either of them had ever had was with this business and each other, and they knew it. Maybe it wasn't true love, but it worked. Somehow. Finally, Margie and Joseph cut the cake, each feeding the other a bite, skipping the smashing of it in each other's faces, which we as a company lobbied against, always. With the dessert table fair game, I went to the bathroom, where I checked all the toilets for problems and paper and wiped down the sink counter. Then it was back through the ballroom and outside to the patio, where a few kids were running around on the dance floor as the DJ got ready to start playing the real music. I swung by the nearby bar, picking up two waters, then delivered one to him, asking if he needed anything. When he said no, I walked over to the steps that led to the beach where someone had left a couple of little plates and a wine glass with a napkin stuffed into it. I was just putting them on a tray table when I heard the early first notes of a Motown song. By the time I turned around, people were already coming through the doors, following the music. There are always phases to dancing at receptions. Usually, kids and older people are first to take the floor due to a lack of self-consciousness. By the second song, you could count on a few of the more tipsy people to join them, often in the form of a clump of girls, all out shaking it together. Younger couples were next, followed by single guys who tended to need some coaxing to join in. Eventually, though, if the drinks were flowing and the DJ decent, you had a packed floor of all types. William always said the best part of weddings was the dancing, and I had to agree with him. People just stopped caring. One night away from the norm, with the people you know best or barely at all. If you couldn't cut loose then, when could you? I edged past a circle of bridesmaids bumping hips, then an older couple doing some complicated spin-out and back footwork, my eye on a nearby ledge cluttered with empty champagne glasses. I was so focused I didn't even notice the young groomsman from earlier approaching until he was right beside me. "Want to dance?" I turned, taking him in. The short hair, those blue eyes, the black bow tie I'd picked up earlier loose but not undone around his neck. "No, thanks." He looked surprised and, I realized, horrified, embarrassed. "Oh, okay." "I'm working," I said quickly, stepping over his last syllables. Now we were both blushing. "For the wedding planner, so I can't..." "Oh, right." His face relaxed. "I didn't realize." "I know, it's fine." I looked at the floor, tucking a piece of hair behind my ear. "Thank you, anyway." He smiled then, and there was something about the way it changed his face, taking it from cute to outright charming that suddenly made me wish I could say yes. To a boy, and a dance, and also to having that chance one night to be away from everything. We stood there a minute, until the bridesmaids nearby opened up their circle, whooping, and pulled him in. I walked over to the ledge I'd seen earlier, collecting the glasses and putting them on a nearby tray. Underneath one of the chairs was another penny card, face down, and I picked it up, rubbing my finger over the coin. When I looked back at the dance floor, the boy and the bridesmaids were gone. That could have been it. And sometimes, on my worst nights, when I couldn't sleep for all the tears, I wished that it was. Because then, Ethan wouldn't have been Ethan to me, but just a guy I said no to at one wedding among so many in a long summer. Nothing more, nothing less, nothing to lose. As it was, a few minutes later, I stopped by to check in with William and my mother, who were standing off to the side of the dance floor, watching one of Margie's aunts dance suggestively against a heavy-set man in a sport coat. "The power of champagne," he said as the woman turned, bumping her ample rear against the man's hip. "She's told me twice tonight she never drinks it, each time with a mostly empty glass in her hand." "Weddings are a different world," I replied, using one of his favorite phrases. "Indeed they are." The couple were now outright grinding each other. "And right now, I want to go home." "My eyes," my mother said in a low voice, fake horrified at the spectacle. "I'm too old for this." "They're senior citizens," William said, and they both cackled. "And I was promised an early night off.
I said, looking at my mom. Can I go? Wait, Luna gets to leave? How is that fair?
Because she's 17 and paid poorly, my mom told William. Her bosses are awful people.
I have heard that, he agreed. He smiled at me.
What are you going to do?
I don't know, I said. Whatever I want.
Look at our girl, single and ready to mingle at the beach. She's acting like a real teenager.
He beamed at me, then looked at my mom. I so hoped this day would come.
Stop, my mom said, pretending to fan her eyes. I'll get emotional.
Shut up, both of you, I said, and they laughed again. I'll see you tomorrow.
You're young and so is the night. Carpe diem, William called out after me as I walked across the patio.
That means day, William, my mom said.
Carpe night, then.
They dissolved into more laughter. Fine, I thought, as I started across the patio to the lobby. So what if I did go back to my room and be non-epic by Jilly's definition? It had been a long day and weekend, and I was tired. I had all of senior year in college to throw down if I so chose, and maybe I would. If I didn't, though, it wasn't my mom and William's business by any stretch. And really, I was only what they had made me. As I thought this, the DJ began another song, slower this time. As some couples began to leave the dance floor and others headed in that direction, I stepped out of the way. On the other side of the crowd, my mom and William were still talking, occasionally breaking into bouts of laughter. Finally, a path cleared inside to the ballroom, but instead of taking it, I went down the steps to the dark beach below. Later, I'd think of this as the true, real start of that night, where everything began. Maybe that was why, halfway down, I kicked off my sandals, stepping into the sand with my feet bare.
Chapter 4.
I can't believe you waited until now to buy an outfit for graduation, Jilly said from outside the dressing room. You don't leave anything until the last minute. That's my thing.
True, I told her, pulling my shirt over my head. But I've been busy, and I told you I didn't think I needed something new anyway. My gown will be over whatever I wear.
At the ceremony?
Her voice grew closer, along with her feet, toes dark red, in platform espadrilles, now just under the door.
But what about all the parties afterward?
There was that word again. I made a face in the mirror, hearing it.
And don't think you're getting out of being social this time, she said, as if she had actually seen this reaction through the door. We're making memories, remember?
Now I groaned aloud, and she laughed. A couple of days earlier, we'd stood in line to pick up our yearbooks during lunch period, one of what felt like endless senior year milestones in the days leading up to graduation. The books themselves were heavy and smelled of leather, with this year's theme embossed in big yellow letters across the cover, Making Memories. It was cheesy and ridiculous, which was why Jilly had claimed it as our summer rallying cry, starting, well, now. No longer was it enough to do things and make stuff happen. It all had to be memorable as well. It was also imperative, apparently, that I have a new dress for graduation, even though, because of work, I had more than enough options in my closet. So here I was, at one of Jilly's favorite boutiques, only hours before the ceremony, with her twin 8-year-old sisters, Caitlin and Catherine, collectively known as Kit Kat, hunched over her phone nearby, bickering as they played Igloo Melt.
It's my turn, I heard Kitty say. Although they were identical and often dressed alike by choice, their voices were the dead giveaways. Kitty was loud, boisterous, while Kat often didn't speak above a whisper unless implored to do so. She must have responded because Kitty said,
Okay, but then I get an extra long one. And your bonus cubes.
Pipe down, loudmouth. We're in public, Jilly told her. There was a clank, and another dress appeared over the top of my dressing room door, this one cobalt blue. I pulled the first she'd picked, a bright pink dress with a short skirt off the hanger, and stepped into it, reaching behind me for the zipper. One glance, and I knew it wasn't me, but still, I opened the door.
Nope, she announced from the seat she'd taken on a polka-dotted chaise directly across from the dressing rooms.
Too much. I was going for pert and perky, but it's more, like, startling. This from a person who is basically the brightest thing in the room right now. She looked down at her yellow romper, which out in the actual sun had almost blinded me.
Yes, but I like color and can therefore pull it off.
Try the next one. I like color, I grumbled. As I turned back to the room, a sales girl studying a laptop by the register gave me a sympathetic smile.
My turn! Kitty bellowed. Now!
Work it out or nobody plays, Jilly told them in a tired voice, then said to me,
Try the A-line next. That's the blue one.
I know what an A-line is.
Do you, though?
I rolled my eyes at my own reflection, reminded again why I always hated being on this side of the dressing room door. I was used to tagging along shopping with Jilly, who believed strongly in the power of retail therapy. But things always worked better when I was flipping through magazines waiting for her to model the looks. Our friendship worked because we each knew our strengths, and now I felt like we were both miscast. The blue dress was better color-wise, but it made my boobs seem sort of pointy. This seemed strange to opine aloud, however, so I went back outside without comment.
Nope, your boobs look weird.
She squinted at them.
Although, it is kind of interesting. Torpedo-like.
You'd definitely get attention. That's not the kind of attention I want. I went back to the dressing room, shedding the dress, then eyed my last selection, a deep plum sheath with a V-neck.
Are you serious with this purple? Really?
It's eggplant and very much in fashion right now, she replied.
Put it on.
I did, glancing at my watch as I pulled my arm through. It was just after 3:30, which meant I didn't have long to stop by my mom's office to check in, then get home and change before meeting her and William at school for the ceremony. They were coming straight from a meeting for B. Little's wedding, about which everything, it seemed, was happening last minute. B. was lovely, which was good because her event, despite William's initial confidence, had become your basic wedding planner nightmare. First, the venue, a gorgeous old house with expansive gardens and a pond, had caught on fire just after she put down a hefty, last-minute, deposit on it. Then the caterer, she insisted was her only deal-breaker in terms of vendors, had a nervous breakdown, although not over this wedding. My mother was not yet convinced of this. All this would have been bad enough even if her own mother's event, which had gone so well, her son's vanishing act aside, oh, how we loved a third wedding, had not resulted soon after the honeymoon in a separation due to incompatibility issues. Even my mother and William had been blindsided. They didn't bet on third weddings, feeling that by then you should know what you're doing. The upshot. With 9 weeks to go, they now found themselves in the busiest part of the wedding season with no venue, no caterer, and a mother of the bride who was even more cynical about the process than they were. I pulled on the last option Jilly had chosen for me, slipping it over my head. When I glanced in the dressing room mirror, it did seem awfully purple, although I liked the plain yet classic neckline and the way the skirt's hem flared up and out at the bottom. I had just stepped out to see what Jilly thought when the sales girl gasped,
putting a hand to her mouth. We both looked over at her.
"What is it?"
Jilly asked. She looked up at us, startled, like she'd forgotten we were there.
"Sorry, I was just... It's the news. There's been a shooting."
I felt a prickle at the back of my neck, hairs rising up. Immediately, Jilly glanced at the twins, who were still absorbed in their game, then put a hand on my arm.
"This one looks good. Who knew eggplant was your color?"
"What kind of shooting?" I asked the sales girl, although I could swear I already knew. There was something in her face I recognized.
"I'm sorry," she said again. She dropped her hand, shaking her head.
"It's a school. In California. Just breaking news right now. They don't have any..."
"Come on,"
Jilly said, her voice firm as she steered me back into the room, shutting the door behind me. From outside, she said,
"You don't really need a dress. Like you said, you have tons. Let's just go."
I stood there a second, looking at my reflection. I could see myself blinking quickly before I turned away, fingers fumbling to pull the dress up over my head. Ignoring the hanger, I left it in a heap on the bench in my haste to put my shorts, t-shirt, and flip-flops back on and grab my purse. Outside, Jilly was waiting, reaching down wordlessly to take my hand. As we walked behind the counter, with the twins in tow, the sales girl was still focused on her computer, and I averted my eyes so I wouldn't see the screen. But I knew what was most likely there, as well as to come. A long shot of a flat, nondescript building, maybe with a mascot on the side. People streaming outdoors, hands over their heads. The embraces of the survivors, mouths open, caught in wails we were lucky not to hear. And, in the worst case, pictures of kids just like the ones in my own yearbook, lined up neatly, already ghosts. By the time I got to my mom's office, I'd somewhat calmed down. Jilly had helped, turning up the radio loud as she drove us through town, now and then taking glances at me she thought I didn't notice. It was gorgeous out, with a bright blue sky, and people were out on the sidewalks and in their cars, windows down, while elsewhere someone's worst nightmare had only just become real. It seemed wrong, like there should have been a stain on the day or something.
"Are you sure you don't want us to hang out for a few minutes?"
Jilly asked me as she pulled into the lot of my mom's office, where I'd left my car parked earlier.
"All I have left to do is pick up Crawford's new glasses and then grab him from Taekwondo."
"Another pair of glasses?" I asked. She glanced at the twins in the rear view, each looking out a separate window, sitting close to each other.
"The kid got suspended this time. We'll see if it makes a difference."
Although I found Crawford's monotone and awkwardness appealing, it made him a huge target for the bullies at his school. Martial arts had made him strong, but not made much of a difference in the lunch line, at least not yet. In the meantime, the bakers spent a lot on replacement eyewear.
"I'm fine. You should go," I told her. "I'll see you at the amphitheater."
"Here's hoping Steve passes out and doesn't make it. Fingers crossed." She laughed, and I did too, if only to convince her I was, in fact, okay. With her baker and me Barrett, we'd spent our lives in the small town with Steve Baroff wedged between us for every alphabetical occasion, except when he was too stoned to show up for school. We'd long hoped this would happen for graduation, if only for the continuity of us being on the stage at the same time. Making memories indeed. As she drove off, already cranking the radio, I started toward my mom's office. Natalie Barrett Weddings was located in the center of a modern office building with a dentist's office on one side, a high-end stationery store called RSVP on the other. Entirely too much of my paycheck had gone to the latter due to my weakness for cards, writing paper, and especially blank books. Life seemed so much more manageable when you could write it down neatly on paper, which was probably exactly why I could only do it for a day or two, and hadn't even tried in the last year. When I looked through those old, barely begun journals now, the events on the pages seemed too small to even fill the lines, that inconsequential. Thinking this, I had a flash of the sales girl and her computer and felt a chill come over me. I pulled open the door to my mom's office where the AC was always blasting and I wouldn't notice my own drop in temperature. William saw me, though, immediately getting up from his seat at the conference table across from B and coming over. I had a news alert on my phone, he said in a low voice. Distantly, I heard my mom, also at the table, saying something about headcounts. You okay? Fine, I said automatically. Go back to your meeting. I just came to drop off the tickets. He nodded, but still waited a beat, as if I might change my mind before returning to the group. Meanwhile, I slipped into the back office, where I reached into my pocket, pulling out the two passes I'd picked up for the ceremony. You were allowed up to six, but it wasn't like I needed any more. I slid them into my mom's purse, which was sitting on her side of the big desk they shared, then went back out into the main room. "We're supposed to meet me a half hour ago," B was saying to her brother Ambrose, who had joined the group in my brief absence. Dressed in jeans, a short-sleeved blue button-down shirt, and tennis shoes, he looked freshly showered, as if just beginning his day at this late hour. Maybe this was why his sister, usually so pleasant, seemed annoyed. "It's no wonder you can't get a job if you're incapable of getting places on time."
"My watch is broken," he said, "and then I had to get here, so..."
Bee's cheeks were flushed.
"You have a phone, Ambrose, and there are clocks!"
An awkward silence settled over the room, during which he spotted me and smiled, waving energetically, as if we were longtime friends finally reunited. His complete lack of caring for the trouble he'd caused would have been impressive if it didn't seem so demented. I was still deciding how to react when my mom said, "So, Luna, how does it feel to be almost free from the compulsory education system?" Now everyone looked at me. Even when I wasn't working, I was working. "I won't believe it until I flip my tassel," I replied.
"Luna's graduating tonight," William explained to B. "High school."
"Really?"
She smiled at me. Beside her, Ambrose noticed William's fancy stainless steel tape dispenser. We were both suckers for office supplies, and pulled it toward him.
"Congratulations," B said. "What a milestone. I remember every minute of my commencement."
"Me too," Ambrose said.
Although damp, I noticed his hair was in full effect, that one curl pushed away from his face, but about to tumble down again.
"You didn't graduate,"
his sister pointed out. To us, she added,
"It was one of those leave quietly and we won't expel you kind of situations. Classic Ambrose."
"I was talking about yours,"
he said, pushing the button on the dispenser. It whirred, spitting out a single piece of tape.
"And it was never proven that I brought the cow in, if you'll recall."
My mother raised that one eyebrow.
"Cow?"
"So what are you doing next year, Luna?"
B said quickly, turning her attention back to me. Whatever had happened with farm animals, she didn't want to dwell on it.
"I'm going to Rice Johnson," I replied.
"It's a private liberal arts college, her first choice, and she got a partial scholarship,"
William added proudly.
"That's great,"
B told me as Ambrose hit the switch again. Then again. Two pieces of tape popped out, and he grabbed them, sticking them to his thumbs.
"I went to DeFreeze,
majored in public policy. I loved college.
It's just so hard to believe, William told her.
I feel like she just started kindergarten. Time just flies.
Oh, dear, I thought, hearing his voice grow tight as he finished this sentence.
William, pace yourself.
My mom, also noticing, advised, we've still got the whole night ahead of us.
He nodded, even as he took out a folded tissue, dabbing at his eyes. If my mom and William were one person, and it often felt like they were, to me, she'd always been the head and he the heart. Sure, they were equally cynical when it came to their business and the main concept that underscored it. But if she could joke or reason away anything that made her feel, it was often because William took it to heart twice as hard. This was especially true when it came to me. First day of kindergarten, first sleepover, first time my heart was broken. It was William who sympathy cried or clung to my hand just a beat too long before I walked out the door. And thank God for it. I loved my mom, but with just her, I might have never known what compassion looked like.
Speaking of later plans, we need to move this along, he said now, looking at the notebook open in front of him. To recap, we've touched on the latest with the venue and catering, and I'll reach out to these top three of the five ideals for the rehearsal dinner to check on availability. Are the guest numbers still pretty firm for that?
Bee, in pearl earrings with her hair pulled back in a daisy-patterned headband, flipped open the cover of her tablet and swiped through a few screens. Beside her, Ambrose picked up the dispenser and turned it upside down, examining its base. 78 with wedding party and all out-of-town family.
And have you sent invitations?
My mom asked. 4 weeks ago, Bee replied, sitting up straighter. It was obvious she sensed my mom's apprehension about this event and was eager to please her. So far, we're at 200 RSVPs, with a final estimate of 250. My mom glanced at William, who gave her a smug look. Big weddings meant big money, and with Bee's fiancé, Kevin Yu, from a family that owned a big pharmaceutical company, big attention. Personally, I wanted to know if she planned to change her name, switching from Bee Little to Bee U, but had not found a way to work this into a meeting. Yet.
You really think any place that you'd want to use can handle a party of 78 on a Friday night only 9 weeks out?
My mom asked, as Ambrose, apparently still fascinated by the dispenser, put it back on the table and pushed its button several times in a row. Click, click, click.
If there's a possibility of a magazine spread, yes, William replied, over the sound of the machine whirring, discharging tape pieces.
You can't make room where there isn't any.
There's always a way.
In the midst of all of this, the machine started making a grinding noise. Then, a long squeak. We all looked at Ambrose, who reached out and hit the button again.
I just feel that you... my mom said, but that was as far as she got before Ambrose picked up the dispenser again, trying to turn it off. When he couldn't, he stuck it in his lap, under the table, where it continued to grind louder and louder until I heard a pop. Suddenly, there was a lot of tape on the floor at my feet, as well as a faint smell of smoke.
Ambrose! Bee screeched, losing her cool entirely. She whirled in her seat, snatching the dispenser from his lap.
God! Stop it!
I was just... Ambrose said. Delicately, my mother reached down, pulling a piece of tape off her foot and putting it on her folder.
I don't care! Bee said. You're always doing something, and it's never what you should be doing, and now Mom's had enough, and I'm stuck with you, so fucking shut up and sit there and don't touch anything!
Silence. Out of habit, I glanced at William, who looked both horrified and thrilled by this development. I had to admit, I was too. Bee cursing was wholly unexpected. My mom, however, was hardly fazed as she said, "All I'm saying is that I think you need to keep your expectations in check." At this, Bee burst into tears. As she put her hands to her pretty face, shoulders shaking, Ambrose patted her